This is the Environment Show. It's about our stewardship of the Earth and the beauty and mystery of life in all its forms. The Environment Show is a national production made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation, the Packard Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the J. M. Kaplan Fund, and Hemmings Motor News, the Bible of the collector car hobby, 1-800-CAR-HERE. Your host is Peter Burley.
Coming up on this week's Environment Show, Walmarts and tract housing is sprawling across America's landscape. We travel to Maryland, which has taken a stand against sprawl by refusing to pay for it. And we look at the loss of farmland in this country, which sprawl is gobbling up at the rate of more than 600,000 acres a year. Listener comments about ecotourism, hydroelectric dams, and polluted fish. A portrait of the Adirondack Mountains of northern New York. And in the Earth calendar, salamander eggs are gestating in the vernal pools of New England. These stories and more coming up on this week's Environment Show. If your city or town is like most, development has moved away from downtown and towards the edges. In short, sprawl development has come to town, dropping McDonald's, Walmarts, and strip malls in a sea of asphalt parking lots and freeways. Besides being architecturally unsightly, sprawl has a big impact on the environment. Recently, the state of Maryland passed a first-of-its-kind anti-sprawl bill. It's hoped that provisions of the bill will rein in the state's tremendous growth and preserve its fragile environment. The Environment Show's Thomas Lally reports from Annapolis, Maryland.
West Street on the edge of Annapolis could be just about anywhere, Los Angeles, Long Island, or Florida. It's a four-lane road lined with national franchises. No one walks along this part of West Street. If you want to go anywhere, you drive in a car. Places like this are possible because taxpayer money builds and maintains the roads, sewer, and water lines, while places like downtown Annapolis, where the infrastructure already exists, are often neglected.
As you extend public services like sewer and water out beyond existing areas, you need to put as many users on those services as possible to keep the cost per user down. If you don't do that, then the cost for the system becomes very high for the individual user and also becomes very high for the system at large.
Chris Hughes is with the Maryland Association of Counties. We sat on a bench in the heart of Annapolis overlooking a row of 19th century townhouses on a narrow and quaint street. Earlier this year, Maryland passed a law to protect and create more areas like this one and combat sprawl. The law requires that state funds for infrastructure only go to areas of concentrated development, making sprawl less likely.
What the bill does is it has local governments designating what are called priority funding areas. That ensures that the local planning process, that each community will be able to develop and assess those areas where money should be spent by the state. In those areas where the local communities have decided is where they want to grow, where it makes the most sense to target state, use state dollars to leverage development in those areas.
The bill passed with overwhelming public support. Marylanders, like others around the country, are seeing their communities grow like never before. At the same time, their cities are emptying out. This trend has meant fewer forests and more highways and pollution. Hughes says we know why this is happening. The few quality urban areas, like downtown Annapolis, are out of most people's price range. Right across from us, a two-story wood-framed house had just sold for $400,000. So often the only affordable option is to live in sprawl. Hughes says this bill still allows sprawl to happen, but state funding won't support it anymore.
This is America, and we do have property rights, and we have the ability, if you own a piece of land, to develop it in whatever way you're allowed under law, but you're not allowed to be deprived of your use, your reasonable use of the property. And in many cases, that means a residential use.
One of those residential sprawl areas is here, about 10 miles outside of Annapolis, in a suburban community called Cape St. Clair. It's a pretty development, right on the Chesapeake Bay, where children play safely in the streets. But you can't really walk to get anywhere in Cape St. Clair. In contrast, an estimated 20% of commuter trips in Annapolis are by walking. At one of the community's beaches on the Chesapeake, an osprey circles overhead and cormorants bob on the water. Houses occupy much of the shoreline. Their owners were attracted here by the bay's natural beauty, but ironically, it's their presence, along with the roads, shopping malls, and cars, which may ruin the bay. George Maurer is with the Chesapeake Bay Society, an environmental group. He says Maryland's new anti-sprawl approach signals a major change from the old style of development.
There is one thing that we should make no mistake about. Sprawl is a product of local planning and zoning. Local planning and zoning is, in essence, the genetic code that produces sprawl. And today, we have planning and zoning standards that are 1950 standards. They're archaic. We're about to enter the 21st century. We need to adopt new rules and regulations that make sense for this new era that we're about to enter. And we have problems today that weren't problems in the 50s. Traffic congestion, pollution, the loss of massive areas of farmland and forest land, pollution of our water bodies. We've got to adopt a different pattern of development. Sprawl makes no sense.
Maurer says if sprawl is a runaway train, this legislation applies the brakes. That's because it takes a long time to develop land. What we see today is often based on rules made 10 or more years ago. Maurer says Maryland still must confront serious issues of air and water pollution and the very real threat that the state's premier natural resource, the Chesapeake Bay, may never regain its former glory.
Well, I think what this bill represents is a first step forward in removing the public subsidies, the massive public subsidies that make sprawl possible. I believe that these public subsidies are the Achilles heel of sprawl. We're talking about subsidies at the local level, at the state level, and at the federal level. We've built a public policy structure, an edifice over the last 50 years that makes sprawl possible, that make it pay for developers. It's based on a system where land and the cost of developing land at the urban fringe are artificially cheap, and the real costs are borne by all of us in terms of lost farmland, lost forest land, the pollution that results from extensive auto travel, congestion, the pollution that's affecting the Chesapeake Bay. We've got to end these public subsidies, and we'll see sprawl disappear very quickly.
Not too long ago, sprawl development was the exception rather than the rule. But as our population has grown, nearly all areas of the country have seen concrete replace forests and farmland. George Maurer and Chris Hughes say at one time sprawl made sense. It was cheaper to build in the country, and it was often more pleasant to live there than the city. But now they say the environmental and economic costs of sprawl are too high, and it's time cities become attractive places to live and work, so places like this along the Chesapeake Bay are preserved. For the Environment Show, I'm Thomas Lally.
Two recent studies focus on the continuing loss of America's best farmland. Tim Worman, vice president of a nonprofit group called the American Farmland Trust, has just published a report called Farming on the Edge. He says nationally we've been losing about 1 million acres of farmland to residential and commercial uses every year since his organization was formed in 1980. While losses traditionally have been around major metropolitan areas, that trend is changing.
What we've begun to find is that there are a whole host of new communities springing up around the country, and that the loss of farmland is much more spread across the United States than it had been in the past.
Deborah Bowers has finished a book with Tom Daniels called Holding Our Ground, Protecting America's Farms and Farmland. They found that currently in Minnesota, farmland is going out of production at the rate of 1 acre every 20 minutes. Michigan is losing it at the rate of 10 acres an hour. 300 acres of ranch land in Colorado is being lost to development every day. And in Florida, with the fastest rate of farmland loss in the country, 150,000 acres a year are being converted to other uses. Both research teams concluded that saving American farmland is an environmental goal that can be achieved. Both Powers and Worman say it has to begin at the community level.
The community comes to an understanding that, yes, it has regions of very productive, very important agricultural lands, and that these are important not only to the citizens of the local community, but to the nation as a whole, we think decisions can be made to steer development onto the less productive lands.
Deborah Bowers says one element of protecting farmland is protecting the farm as a business enterprise.
We need to have laws in place that make it easier for farmers to make a profit, basically. But we need to make sure that we can keep farmers in business, because we can't protect farmland, spend a lot of money protecting farmland, and then have those farms go out of business, because that's not good for the local economy.
Despite many federal agricultural programs, Bowers does not think federal policy has done enough to protect farmland.
The federal government has done very little. And depending on your political philosophy, maybe that's the way it should be, to preserve farmland. But on the other hand, the federal government has done a lot to develop farmland, if you look at all of the things that it has done, such as, first of all, build the interstate highway system, which made it possible for people to move out of cities and towns and own their two-acre lots. The federal government, through home financing and mortgage interest deduction and the subsidies for schools and water and sewer, really did, in fact, subsidize sprawl beginning immediately after World War II. And that has continued. And so it's interesting. That seems to have been our federal urban policy, was to decrease vitality of our cities so that people could move out.
Tim Werman from the Farmland Trust gives the Maryland program, which we reported on in an earlier segment of this show, high marks.
We're quite excited about Governor Glendening's new initiative. We think that it's probably the most innovative and aggressive program to date that's been acted at the state level. It's twofold. One, he intends to aggressively push for infrastructure investments that the state would make in existing urban areas and try to avoid encouraging development of open space and agricultural lands. We think that's very positive. He also will be providing additional money to the state's Farmland Protection Program for the purchase of development rights from farmers. Those two things combined can be a very powerful tool to preserve Maryland's agricultural industry.
If you wish to do more to protect farmland in your community, Bowers' book, Holding Our Ground, not only catalogs the land use and estate planning tools available, but also contains sample forms and agreements to help you and your community get started. Again, the book is Holding Our Ground, and it's published by Island Press. I'm Peter Burley. Producer Stephanie Goishman has this week's listener comments.
Every week, we look forward to hearing from our listeners. This week, we received a variety of comments. Here's what Environment Show listeners have to say.
My name is Marty Goulet. I'm from New Braintree, Massachusetts. My call is in response to the gentleman from Northampton who suggested we all stay home and read a book instead of going out and seeing this great country of ours. And it sounds like this country would be better off if he did stay home, because we'd be better off without him. I mean, to suggest that everyone stay home and not have their children experience all the beauty and wonder that is this country just to save a few gallons of gasoline is preposterous. And I don't see how anyone can support that kind of agoraphobic anarchy.
Hi, it's Jim Higgins, and I'm calling from Vermont. I was listening to the show about the Bio River being dammed in Chile, and it struck me very much common. It has very much in common with the project in Quebec, the James Bay project. Very much the same thing, environmental racism and ecological destruction, all for electricity. But also, what didn't get talked about was the big money interests that stand to benefit from it, like Shearson Lehman Brothers. which typically funded projects in Quebec, which are designed to supply Americans.
Hi, my name is Deanne August, and I live in Ulster County, New York. I just heard your story on shad fishing in the Hudson River, and you seem to have missed the real story, which is that there are PCBs in the shad fish from the Hudson River, part of which has just been named as the second most endangered river in the country because of PCB contamination. No one should eat the fish or anything else out of the Hudson River, and people should be aware of PCB contamination traveling into the air we breathe from the river. These issues and discussing ways to clean the river is the real environmental story, and I wish you guys could cover something like that. Thanks. Bye.
Normally, fish from the Hudson and many other rivers in this country are unsafe to eat. But according to state health officials, shad swim in from the ocean and only stay in the Hudson long enough to spawn. Since they don't eat anything, they don't have a chance to pick up any of the PCBs or other pollutants. And therefore, unlike other fish in the Hudson, the shad is safe to eat. If you have comments or questions about the environment, call us at 1-888-49-GREEN. For the Environment Show, I'm Stephanie Goichman.
We all have places which are special to us. For some, they're city streets. For others, they're deep in the wilderness. Author Bill McKibben writes about the difficulty of seeing nature while living in a 20th century lifestyle. It appears in the introduction to the newly re-released edition of Walden by Henry David Thoreau. He presents a portrait of the Adirondack Mountains in New York State.
The hawk sat on a limb 3 feet above my head and did not stir as I walked under. That was the first sign. I'd been off hiking for about a week, a long solo backpack through my home mountains, the Adirondacks of upstate New York. The first few days out, I might as well have been back in my room. I strode purposely along the trail, eyes fixed on that focusless middle distance that you stare at when you drive, and my mind chattered happily away, my own little CNN delivering an around-the-clock broadcast of ideas, plans, opinions. What would I work on next? Who would win the presidential election? What were some neat things I could buy? My mind was literally buzzing, following all its usual tracks, though I was deep in the woods. The days wore on, though. Input dropped. No radio, no paper, no conversation. I could feel the chatter in my head begin to subside. Either the peace of the forest was beginning to penetrate, or the stocks of mental junk food were starting to dwindle. Whatever. The buzz turned to hum, and once in a while to quiet. And so I was not completely surprised when the hawk kept his perch, or a few minutes later when I passed a pair of grazing deer and they merely looked up a moment, didn't spook. I was still wearing the rustling, fluorescent uniform of the modern hiker, but I'd begun, perhaps, to give off fewer, calmer vibrations. I'd been walking through rain for days. It had long since penetrated my Gore-Tex hide, and so that afternoon when the sun finally came out, I made an early camp by the lake. I hung out my clothes in the branches to warm, held my white and wrinkled feet up to the sky to toast, unfolded in the lovely heat like a snake on a stone. Soon a band of merganser chicks, trailing their mother, circled the small cove by which I lay, paying no attention. My invisibility lasted all day, calming one creature after another, until I was feeling part creature myself. Naked, hidden by the fringe of birch leaves, I watched canoeists paddle chattily by, and they seemed nearly as if they belonged to another race. That night I was aware of every second of the endless sunset, the first long rays of the sun as the afternoon turned late, the long twilight, the turn of the sky from blue to blue to blue to... Just as it turned black, a heron came stalking through my tiny cove, standing silently and then spearing with a sudden spasm. I couldn't see her, not really, but I knew where she was. The sky blackened, the stars in this dark place spread across the sky bright and insistent. We were unimaginably small, this heron and I, and extremely right.
Author Bill McKibben reading from his introduction to the new re-release of Walden by Henry David Thoreau. Stay tuned. The Earth Calendar is next.
In New England at this time of year, before the leaves are out, but as the sun rays strengthen, there is water in the vernal pools, and frog and salamander eggs are gestating in them. These pools are found in depressions, often deep in the woods with no apparent outflow. The poet Robert Frost called them spring pools in this poem that he wrote by that name. These pools that, though in forests still reflect, the total sky almost without defect, and like the flowers beside them, chill and shiver, and like the flowers beside them, soon be gone, and yet not out by any brook or river, but by roots to bring dark foliage on. The trees that have it in their pent-up buds to darken nature and be summer woods, let them think twice before they use their powers to blot out and drink up and sweep away these flowery waters and these watery flowers from snow that melted only yesterday. The state of Massachusetts has a program for identifying vernal pools, which are breeding habitat for certain rare and endangered frogs and salamanders. Once a vernal pool has been duly certified, land around it cannot be developed without special review. Last week, I went out with Shep Evans, chairman of the Conservation Commission of Stockbridge, Massachusetts, and a citizen volunteer involved in identifying and certifying vernal pools under the Massachusetts Natural Heritage and Endangered Species Program. We hiked about a mile down an old railroad track, and there, just as Robert Frost described it, was a pool of water, several hundred feet long and a couple of feet deep. It reflected the bare limbs of the trees above it, and I asked Shep what made a vernal pool different from any other kind of pool.
A vernal pool is an impoundment of water, which one of the key things is that it does not have fish living in it. And it has to be of sufficient size to be certified, which this one is. But if the water is there for 4 or 5 months out of the year, and notably at certain times of the year, in this case spring, and there are woodlands around to provide the source of amphibians that would like to breed in the pond, the ingredients are all there. Add thyme and some vegetation, and Mother Nature takes her course.
Bake until well done.
That's right.
Now, Shep, these things we're looking at, what do they look like, and what are they?
These are egg masses. The eggs themselves are about the size of small pearls, and around them is an egg case, or an egg sac, if you will, of albumen and a membrane on the outside of that. The whole thing is about as big as the end of your baby finger, maybe. And they are strung together here. We're looking at spotted salamander egg masses. They're strung together in a group attached to the side of a twig, of a branch in the water. And there may be 25 or 30 of these eggs in a mass right there on the branch.
Evans points out that only a pool without fish can be a vernal pool because fish would eat the salamander and frog's eggs.
Key ingredient is fish. If there are predatory species that would feed on the eggs, then of course they wouldn't be here. Many of these pools fill with runoff water in the spring. They may, in the fall and winter, be simply looking like sort of leafy depressions in the forest with no trees or anything really growing in them much. And they only appear to be ponds or pools in the spring when they fill up.
Evans fills out a form making notes under such headings as Obligate Vernal Pool Breeding Amphibians and Facultative Vernal Pool Invertebrates, enlisting the numbers of the assessor's maps on which the pool is found. He will send these to the Vernal Pool Certification Program of the Massachusetts Division of Fisheries and Wildlife, so that next year the pool will be listed as a recognized breeding ground for the rare Jefferson salamander, spotted salamanders, wood frogs, and other species. Thank goodness the certification program was not in effect during Robert Frost's day. I doubt that even he could make a poem about a nature as defined in terms of obligate or facultative vernal pool breeding amphibians, to say nothing about numbered assessor's maps. Thanks for listening. This is The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. This is The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. Still ahead, we put computers in the bellies of tuna to find out where they go and how deep they swim, while environmentalists disagree about safe ways to catch them. Can restrictions on trade save the tuna or any other species? Author John Barry talks about how the Mississippi River roared to life in 1927. The flood covered thousands of acres in water and forever changed the landscape. And the Grateful Dead sing about the Mississippi in Johnny Cash's song, Big River. These stories still ahead on The Environment Show. For years, tuna fishermen cast their nets around groups of dolphins that they could see on the surface of the sea to catch the tuna that swam underneath them. Tuna caught in that fashion had been banned from the U.S. market in order to protect the dolphins. In a moment, we'll hear a debate about whether the ban should be lifted. But first, we talk to a scientist who has been involved in a project headed by Barbara Block from Stanford University to learn more about where the tuna themselves go. It's a lot more sophisticated than locating tuna by putting nets around groups of dolphins. Carl Safina is head of the National Audubon Society's Living Ocean Program, and he recently participated in a program to plant super high-tech tags in tuna. Basically, they're small computers. And they will log the travels of the tuna for a couple of years.
Well, these tags are about the size of your finger, and they are actually implanted into the fish's abdomen with a little wire trailing to sense the day length. Using the day length, these things can actually compute the latitude and longitude of the fish on a day-to-day basis. Well, the idea is to try to learn for the first time how these fish actually use the environment. We have never been able to watch them because you can't just pull the ocean back and take a look. And conventional tags will tell you where the fish was first caught and where it was caught again, but not what it did in between. These tags tell you what it does in between. And there's the newest generation of tags, which is still in the experiment stage, but they seem to be working. They just put a couple out for the first time. Not only log all the data, but then are pre-programmed to have part of them pop to the surface and start loading that data up to a satellite, which you can then download from your laboratory.
I asked Safina whether all this fancy hardware will enable the scientist to sit in his laboratory and read satellite data instead of actually wrestling with a fish. Apparently, that's not the case.
Well, I have to say, I think that this is the most exciting and one of the most important wildlife research projects in North America. Catching fish that weigh from 200 to 500 pounds is very exciting. What happens is you go out to the edge of the Gulf Stream, and every day they download maps of satellite images of sea surface temperatures so they know where that is, and then there are temperature sensors on the boat. You ride out to the edge of the Gulf Stream and look up and down that temperature edge until you see the fish on your sonar. Then you start throwing handfuls of herring overboard, hoping that you get the fish to come up. And often they do, and suddenly these giant tuna are crashing around behind the boat. And either you can throw them a line or transfer fish from nearby charter boats that are also catching them for sport. Bring the fish through the back door of the transom of the boat, slide it onto the deck, quickly do the surgery, turn it around, slide it back out, usually in under 3 minutes.
Safina says the survivability of the tuna is high even after the stress of this type of capture. The real threat to the future of the fish is the sushi market.
Well, the population off the east coast of the United States has declined by about 85 to 90% since the mid-1970s because the fish are worth a tremendous amount of money in Tokyo for sushi. The average price paid for the fish is probably around $10,000 each, and the record is an astonishing $70,000 paid for one of these giant fish. So there is a great need to conserve them better. There's a great need to learn more about their movements and understand their population trends better than we do now, and also understand where in the ocean they go, how much time they spend here, how many of them might travel to Europe and the Mediterranean, where the fishing is relatively uncontrolled, and whether that might have any effect on management efforts that are put in place here on this side of the ocean or not.
The tagged tuna are caught on a line, a process which requires the researcher to be held in the boat with a safety harness to stop from being pulled overboard. Safina says this does less harm to the fish than other forms of capture.
It does do some damage. There is a hook wound, but the hooks are removed and the wound can heal. Actually, fish often get much more battered up in nets than they get at the end of the line.
So, Carl, if I took one of your tuna tracing devices and put it in my pocket, would that tell my wife where I was when I was not home for dinner?
Only if she caught you.
Carl Safina is head of the National Audubon's Living Ocean Program and has recently been tagging tuna off the coast of North Carolina. When you buy canned tuna in the market, you'll see a label on the can, which is a small fish in a circle, with the words Dolphin Safe printed underneath it. Current law requires that tuna sold in the U.S. market be dolphin safe. It also requires that to be dolphin safe, tuna not be caught by a process which involves putting nets around swimming dolphins to catch the tuna which travel with them. Some environmentalists now assert that new methods to catch tuna by encircling the dolphins have been developed which protect dolphins. Consequently, legislation is now making its way through the Congress which would amend the dolphin safe definition. And it would permit netting tuna under dolphins. Some environmentalists favor the change, others oppose it. We're joined by representatives from two environmental organizations, Nina Young from the Center for Marine Conservation and Sam Libetti from the Marine Mammal Fund. They lock horns over the question, should the legal definition of dolphin safe be amended? Mr. Libetti.
Well, Peter, in the same way that the administration some years ago got a number of D.C. environmental groups to endorse NAFTA and the Environmental Site Agreement, which we now know is not worth the paper it was written on, about a year and a half ago, the administration got several environmental groups to negotiate something called the Panama Declaration. And subsequent to that, this legislation was introduced by such environmental luminaries in Congress as Don Young and Ted Stevens of Alaska and others to basically do three things: to change the definition of dolphin safe, to include tuna that's caught by chasing, encircling, bombing dolphin herds with explosives, catching them in nets, injuring them, and killing them, to lift the U.S. embargoes against tuna caught by purse seining on dolphins, and allow that tuna to be labeled dolphin safe, and to further allow the U.S. tuna fleet, which is now fishing profitably without setting any nets around dolphin herds, to go back to the process
okay.
of killing dolphins.
Ms. Young.
Well, Peter, the Center for Marine Conservation supports the legislation because it's good for dolphins, good for the tuna, and good for the ecosystem. As defined today, Dolphin Safe is a fraud. Dolphins continue to die. They're still encircled. Plus, Dolphin Safe means killing endangered sea turtles, thousands of sharks, and millions of baby tuna. The legislation will eliminate dolphin mortality and will allow dolphin populations to continue to grow. Without this international agreement that's embodied in the legislation, there are no rules, and dolphin deaths will increase.
Sam Libetti in response.
I suppose it's easy for the administration to find spokespersons for their dolphin-deadly legislation when they, like the Center for Marine Conservation, which they give $2 million a year to in federal funding. But the reality is that killing dolphins is not good for them. Killing dolphins, making it legal to kill dolphins, is hardly going to save them any more than it saved the souls of American Indians.
Nina Young in reply. The last word.
Well, Mr. Libetti is relying on a decade-old video. Since that time, the complexion of the fishery has changed, and there's been a 99% reduction in dolphin mortality based on the most recent scientific statistics.
No thanks.
The dolphin population is increasing, and the dolphin population that the is increasing, and the dolphin carnage that Mr. Libetti continues to evoke is just absolutely untrue.
Well, thank you both. We've heard from Nina Young from the Center for Marine Conservation and Sam Libetti from the Marine Mammal Fund debating the issue of whether the dolphin safe definition should be changed. I'm your host, Peter Burley. How to define dolphin-safe tuna is one small part of a host of trade and environment questions which are increasing as more and more efforts are made to facilitate trade on a global basis. Some trade experts believe it's wrong to tie trade policy to environmental questions. Some environmentalists are saying trade is the strongest force shaping environmental practices today, and trade penalties and incentives are useful tools for achieving better environmental performance. The simplest trade environment tool is prohibition of the sale of products which are environmentally unsound, such as tuna caught using techniques that kill dolphins. Critics argue that the environment trade sanctions are too costly and have little impact. Jim Lee of the School of International Service at American University and director of the Trade Environment Database Project has been trying to find out what all of us as consumers pay when one of these trade sanctions goes into effect.
And so I went out and did a study where we tried to calculate the actual trade losses in a number of cases, like the well-known tuna dolphin case, or U.S. sanctions on Taiwan for trading in tigers and rhinos. We did a follow-up study that then tried to look at the environmental benefits that were inferred from these decisions. In other words, if we saved 10 dolphins a year and it cost us $30, well, how much is a dolphin worth then? So we looked at some data and found that for dolphins, for example, it was costing Mexico perhaps $12 million a year, but it was estimated maybe 100,000 dolphins were saved, and therefore that's $118 a dolphin.
Now, when you say it was costing them that, that was revenue that they did not receive, that they would have received if they'd kept on catching dolphins in the conventional way?
That, as well as the fact that U.S. consumers probably paid some more, too. But that's not factored in.
Okay. So, I've got it on dolphins. What did you find with respect to some of the other things you looked at?
If you look at shrimp and sea turtles, which is another matter altogether, because actually dolphins are not endangered, and this isn't a serious threat to the population, but with sea turtles, they're all endangered. And by the same calculations, and this was a case involving Mexico, but also other countries in the Western Hemisphere, this was starting to cost us about $700 a turtle. But in this case, it was absolutely vital to their survival. They probably would go extinct within 10 to 15 years without some kind of protective measures. So you go down the list with species like that, and you can start figuring out how much we're buying for how much we're paying. And when you look at big cases like drift nets, then the animals you save, because there's so many killed, get to be a smaller and smaller number, about $11 or $12. So I did this study not to say what are these animals worth, because perhaps only God knows that. But when we start talking about these things, what kind of valuation are we putting on them? And this is just prices, of course, but I think it reflects some belief system of some kind.
Lee thinks that if more people understood the numbers as he figures them, people will support efforts to save species in peril.
I think you could tell the public how much these things are costing with respect to species, and I think they'd say, you know, I'll pay a little bit extra for my can of tuna, because to the consumer it's just a few cents, to save an important species. But when you start talking about having cleaner airs, saving forests, large-scale pollution of waterways, then adding up these benefits are much more difficult to do. So I guess I'd say to policymakers, why don't we figure out some way of selling the public on protecting species and then move to the more difficult issues.
Dan Esty, director of the Yale Center of Environmental Law and Policy and of the Yale Global Environment and Trade Study, says his research shows that trade bans imposed by one country alone do not have a long-lasting effect because sellers of the environmentally banned products simply find customers elsewhere.
It turns out that the trade world is very concerned that there will be excessive impacts on international trade from efforts to pursue environmental goals with trade measures. But our study shows that, in fact, the effects are relatively small and relatively transitory. That is to say, environmental goals can be pursued with trade measures without severe disruption to the international trade system.
Now, when you think about a ban of imports, obviously, if things were being sold in the United States before and after the ban, they're not, that's got to have some kind of an impact, doesn't it?
Well, it certainly has some impact where products are blocked from the United States market. This is an important market for many countries. But it turns out that products that are kept out of the United States often find places to be sold elsewhere. And so what might have been the full impact is somewhat diminished because they do have an opportunity, the sellers have an opportunity to find other markets for their goods.
But that, it seems to me, then, does not speak well for the environmental impact. If the idea is to stop it from coming into the U.S. to save the tuna and they simply sell them somewhere else, the underlying environmental condition is not helped, is it?
It does demonstrate the value of having environmental goals pursued by many countries simultaneously or multilaterally, as we say. It's much more difficult to get a good result if the United States alone is pursuing a particular environmental goal.
One thing environmentalists do agree on is that environment trade disputes are multiplying rapidly, and that trade policy can indeed be a very important tool for environmental management. They also agree that existing institutions like the World Trade Organization, or WTO, which were set up to settle trade disputes, have little background or experience in managing environmental disputes, even if they are linked to trade. The Environment Show wants to hear from you, and I'm Peter Burley. On future shows, we'll be talking green about environmental justice, chlorine, and brownfields. Our number is 1-888-49-GREEN. That's 1-888-49-GREEN. Our email address is green@wamc.org. Tell us what's on your mind and send us questions you have about the environment. You can visit us anytime on the Internet where you can hear The Environment Show. It's at www.enn.com/envshow. The Mississippi River is a mighty giant, and when it is angry, there's no force on earth strong enough to stop it. Folks who live along the river know this well. In 1993, floods covered huge swaths of land, creating vast inland seas. But even a flood like that one can't compete with a 1927 flood, when water as deep as 30 feet covered an area of land equal to Massachusetts, Connecticut, New Hampshire, and Vermont combined. It was an awesome display of nature's fury and changed the landscape forever. John Barry's new book on this flood is entitled Rising Tide, and it's published by Simon & Schuster. He spoke with Environment Show producer Thomas Lally about this great force of nature.
The river is much of the continental United States. It drains 41% of the continental United States. All are part of 31 states. You could just as easily say that it starts near Buffalo, New York, as you could say that it starts in Minnesota.
Now, you say in the book that the 1927 flood, this tremendous flood of the Mississippi, was really a test of engineering projects supported by the two leading engineers at the time and competing engineers, James Eads and Andrew Humphreys. Now, how did these engineering projects affect the flood?
In fact, Gifford Pinchot, who I'm sure you know, was one of the first conservationists, and in 1927 was governor of Pennsylvania, said that the 27 flood was not a natural disaster, it was a man-made disaster. And he was referring, of course, to this levees-only policy. And the disaster was immense. A million people homeless, 700,000 people fed by the Red Cross for months, with political repercussions and presidential politics and regional politics that are felt today.
Now, bring us up to this to the flood. How did it start? You know, what were the natural events that that led up to it? And also explain exactly what you just mentioned about how this was a man-made disaster and not really a natural disaster.
Okay. Essentially, rain started in August 1926, and it didn't stop. In the fall of 1926, there were record floods at a time when rivers normally are low, 600 miles apart in Kansas and Illinois. In the last 3 months of 1926, every single river gauge on the Missouri River, the Ohio River, and the Mississippi River, every gauge, for an area covering almost a million square miles, set an all-time high average reading. So it had just kept raining. There was a tremendous amount of water already in the river system, and the soil was saturated. And it didn't stop when 1927 started. The levees only policy, which we talked about earlier, could not contain this amount of water. In fact, the policy was, as an engineer named Charles Ellett called it in the 1800s, he called it a delusive hope and dangerous to indulge. It was an idiotic policy, to be blunt. Another engineer named James Kemper said, it is much easier to believe than to think. It is astounding how much more believing is done than thinking. And he was referring directly to this levees-only policy, which the Corps of Engineers insisted upon despite all evidence to the contrary.
Now, contrast this flood with the 93 flood, because that, of course, is what everyone's going to be matching this up with.
Right. The 93 flood was a terrible disaster, but in terms of scope or water, it does frankly not compare with the 27 flood. In 1927, there were 8,000 square miles of Kansas alone flooded. There were deaths from Oklahoma to West Virginia, and yet the greatest damage came on the lower Mississippi from southern Missouri and Illinois to the Gulf of Mexico. On the lower river alone, not counting Kansas, Oklahoma, northern Missouri, Illinois, etc., there were 27,000 square miles flooded.
Now, you say in the book that the landscape changed, of course, because whole areas were destroyed, as well as changing the pattern of development, but also it sent whole populations of people moving to the West Coast and up to Chicago. What was the fallout politically?
Well, Herbert Hoover was Secretary of Commerce, and he was put in charge of taking care of the 700,000 refugees. You all recall the 93 flood, headlines every day for weeks. Well, Hoover's name was in the paper along with the headlines on 1927, also for weeks, and he was always portrayed as a hero. And that created his presidential candidacy. But on a larger scale, the impact of the flood helped redefine how people viewed the federal government and helped prepare the way, ironically, since it also elected Hoover, but it actually helped prepare the way for the New Deal.
Author John Barry, speaking with Environment Show producer Thomas Lally about his new book, Rising Tide, published by Simon & Schuster. Despite devastating floods, communities have thrived along the Mississippi River for over 1,000 years. Today, it remains a key highway for goods going in and out of the Midwest. But besides commerce, the Mississippi's mysterious and swirling currents have provoked the imagination of all those who live on her shores. Johnny Cash's classic song, Big River, describes a poor sap who follows a woman from the river's headwaters in Minnesota all the way down to New Orleans. It's performed here by the Grateful Dead. Grateful Dead performing Big River, written by Johnny Cash. This performance is from the Great American Music Hall in August of 1975. Thanks for being with us on this week's Environment Show. I'm Peter Burley. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-888-49-GREEN and ask for show number 383. The Environment Show is a presentation of National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Dr. Alan Shartok is the executive producer, Thomas Lally is producer, and Stephanie Goishman is the associate producer. The Environment Show is made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the J.M. Kaplan Fund, the Packard Foundation, and Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the collector car hobby, 1-800-CAR-HERE. So long, and join us next week for The Environment Show.